Todd Rokita might be a bad boss. Curtis Hill backs military supplies for police. That, plus Connie Lawson says early voting doesn't equal higher turnout, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 1st, 2017.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, a report that Congressman Todd Rokita treats staffers rather harshly, which includes reducing several to tears.
A story from the Associated Press includes accounts of 10 former Rokita staffers, most choosing to remain anonymous for fear of reprisals from Republican Congressman and Senate hopeful Rokita. Stories include Rokita forcing a staffer to clean out his car because of a driver's body odor.
Oh, this isn't even B.O. This is beyond B.O. It's B.B.O.
A tense confrontation with a high school teacher in a class Rokita was speaking to, and docking staffers' pay for minor errors in press releases. The report also notes that staffer turnover in Rokita's office is twice as high as the rest of Indiana's congressional delegation. Rokita says he demands excellence from himself and those who work for him.
Willie's stories from former staffers have voters turning sour on Rokita. It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Katzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. And Delaney, Rokita's campaign has shrugged these off as exaggerated claims from disgruntled ex-staffers, but will voters do the same thing?
Depends on whether they meet him or not. It seems to me that the more you know of Todd Rokita, the less you like him. You know, some of people have suggested he has a new nickname, and it's short for Richard. That's what some people are saying.
That's what people are saying. That's
right.
What,
I saying. Would not say
you're,
that.
You would never say that.
Never.
People are saying.
People are saying. You know, the irony of this is his whole slogan is, you know, I'm going to attack the elite. I'm going to defeat the elite. He thinks he's going to be carried around by servants on a sedan chair. That's what that 8-page memo and all of this ranting is about. He thinks he's entitled, which is exactly what most people dislike about people in the elite, that they think they have an entitlement to special treatment, and obviously that's sunk in with Todd Rokita.
Is this story going to resonate with voters?
I don't think it'll have a lasting effect. I worked for Todd Rokita. I ran his 2006 campaign. He's a demanding guy. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I've worked for Mitch Daniels and Eric Holcomb and a lot of guys with big titles, and he's among the most demanding people I've ever worked for, and that's certainly felt at the staff, especially at the staff level. So I think voters want that. I think they want a fighter. I think this is going to be a tough election year, and I think, you know, he's entering it the right way. I think this has been a tough primary so far. It's going to get tougher between now, what, four, five, six candidates, and three really kind of top-tier candidates. I think Rokita among all of them right now appears toughest and ready to go into the 18 with open eyes.
To that point, is there something to this that the sort of personality that leads to a story like this will actually end up helping Todd Rokita in what could be and is already shaping up to be a bruising primary?
I wouldn't go that far. I don't see how it necessarily helps, because you never know what's going to resonate with voters. You know, you'd like to think that all of the elections and campaigns are decided on stances on issues and policy questions. But there are certain issues that people can relate to. They may not be able to relate to nuclear proliferation or, you know, metering or any of those things. But we've all had bosses that were demanding and we didn't like working for. And when they hear those stories, that may actually resonate at a gut level the way that certain other sorts of more highfalutin policy types of issues wouldn't. So I wouldn't discount it as an issue. And I don't think it helps him. I'd have to think that through. But yes, he's driven, and probably everybody who's been elected to Congress has in some fashion been a tough boss, because you basically
you
have
to be
driven to put your name on the ballot. And so I'm not saying that he's the only member of the other 400 and, you know, 34
people.
They
don't all have 8-page memos.
Okay, maybe that. But.
Well, to this story on the staffers, there were sort of two responses from the Rokita campaign. One, from Rokita himself saying, oh, I expect excellence, I demand excellence and hard work from myself and the people who work for me. But then you have a campaign spokesperson who says, oh, it's just disgruntled former staffers. Do either one of those work for you? Does one work a little better?
Well, you know, I give Rokita credit for owning it, as you know, he should. If that's the way he is, and that is what he expects, then it would be foolish for him to try to say something different. There's a difference, though, between a tough boss, a demanding boss, and one who demeans people. And if that's what's being said here, that he's demeaning to the people who work for him, then it doesn't help him at all. Because, you know, it's one thing to work hard for somebody to meet expectations when they're set really high, but it's another one to work really hard for someone, and if you don't make it, then they demean you. You know, it's hard to respect somebody like that, and I think voters will respond poorly to that if that's what continues to keep coming out.
Right, if that is a lasting impression.
To your point there, you want to inspire people to work hard. And when you demean them, and when you take money away from them, they don't pay them very much to begin with, and you penalize them financially in addition to that, that doesn't inspire the kind of loyalty, it seems to me, that you would need in that kind of position.
And that's what some folks have said in response to this, is that you wouldn't have this kind of story from somebody, from people who
were loyal.
Some unfair accusations in that story, too. I mean, there was one staffer off the record who said, we were expected to work after hours, on the weekends, when the congressman was working, and we've all worked in these jobs. I mean, that's the job.
Right.
That is what you're signing up for.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to, and if you want to show up at 8:30 and leave at 4:15, I mean, do not go work for a member of Congress.
Right. The White House rolled back Obama-era rules this week to once again allow police departments to purchase military surplus equipment.
The Obama administration in 2015 put restrictions on the ability of police departments to buy surplus military equipment, including grenade launchers, armored vehicles, and riot gear. President Trump this week eliminated those restrictions, with officials arguing the rules prohibited the purchase of life-saving equipment because of, quote, superficial concerns. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill supports the Trump administration move. He says police often deal with significant situations, citing recent white supremacist rallies and violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hill says ending the ban gives police access to everything from ammunition to office supplies and will ensure law enforcement is prepared for every possible scenario.
Mike O'Brien, why shouldn't police have access to the equipment they might need for any possible scenario, as Curtis Hill puts it?
I think they should. This is personal for me. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. I grew up in a really nice kind of bedroom community, middle-class neighborhood. My dad was a police officer on the south side of Chicago. And that community became kind of a war zone, and is to this day, when gangs came in and the police needed, they were outmatched back then. And, I mean, do they need grenade launchers in Avon, Indiana, where I live now? No, probably not.
Right? But depends on what's going on in Avon.
But now that you live there.
But I'm like, I want to preserve the right of these local law enforcement police departments to assess their local need and then equip themselves appropriately. I think the second part of this, the danger that's always brought up is that there are aggressive police officers that are using excessive force, and that's true, and that's problematic. I think a lot of times what we find are those officers have a history of violence, they have a history of domestic abuse or anger and other things. What I would like to see, in addition to equipping these officers as well as you can, really minding on the front end who are allowing to become police officers.
This we talked about on this show and on a lot of discussion about how police departments across the country, across the state, are underfunded, that they need the funds to fight the kind of battles that they have to fight every day. Isn't this a good way to help? I mean, we're talking about the military surplus equipment. They're not buying it for exorbitant rates. Isn't this exactly the sort of thing that might help?
Yes, it can. It has the potential for doing that, and yes, we do need to equip them. I remember watching the chief of police a few years ago go to a not-for-profit foundation to buy jackets or bulletproof vests for their employees. That was outrageous to me that you would have to do that, that the taxpayers weren't funding that. And property tax caps have exacerbated that problem. So having access to certain of these pieces of equipment is a good thing. I don't want the police to look like the military, however. I don't want to see tanks rolling down streets. I don't want to see that kind of enforcement. I am glad to see Curtis Hill is pro-police officer here, because a couple of weeks ago he was siding in the anti-police officer situation, taking a position in that Virginia case about the stopping of the African-American man. So that's good on one level. I think he would be more constructive if he would stand up and say that people with mental health issues and people on the terror watch list should not have guns. And that would frankly do more for police officer safety than any other single thing we do.
Curtis Hill did mention the Charlottesville, Virginia incident in his op-ed. Is that a good example of the police need to have access to more stuff than you might think they need?
You know, I struggle with this because I see the points that have been made to this point, and I agree. Police need to have the equipment that they need, and they should be able to assess that on a per-department basis. The needs in Avon are much different than the needs in Chicago and all of that. But I do worry about the kind of the paramilitarization of our civilian police department. And while I think that they should have equipment available for when you have a mass demonstration, I'm not sure that armored vehicles and that kind of thing are necessary for the police department. I think the better solution here is for the National Guard or other groups that are trained and are familiar with these kinds of things work in coordination with the police so that our police can remain our civilian protectors and the military remains the military. And you can get the job done, but you need to have coordination. You need to have a lot of cooperation to make that happen. That's hard.
Is perhaps the best answer here neither the Obama-era total ban or the complete repeal of that total ban, but something in the middle where, I mean, Curtis Hill makes the point. We're not just talking about armored vehicles and grenade launchers. We're talking about office equipment and computers.
Sure.
Is perhaps there more of a middle ground that should have been struck?
Again, I remember how horrifying it was, what was this, 5-6 years ago to watch a bank robbery gone sour. There was a shootout, I think it was L.A., where the police were so outgunned. I mean, the bad guys had automatic weapons, and there were handguns that the police had. I mean, just horrifying. So from that standpoint, yes, we want to see police. But you're right. They don't need bayonets. And under this program, 12,000 bayonets have been distributed. Now, when questioned during there were congressional hearings at one point, they said, why do you need bayonets? And they said, well, to extricate people after car crashes, we can cut them their seat belts off, which I don't want to see somebody coming at me with a bayonet if I'm pinned in a car.
There's Civil War reenactors.
And the other point, so there is some common sense. And the Government Accountability Office just a few months ago this summer set up a sting, basically, a bogus police agency with a fake website and an address that went to an empty lot and ended up getting $1.2 million worth of serious equipment.
We're not asking or even discussing the fundamental question. How come the criminals have these? How come we make them so readily available? Well, so then we have to arm our people the same way so we can have the OK Corral with automatic weapons in downtown L.A.? That's the problem. The Second Amendment is looked as absolutely sacred. Every other amendment can be tweaked or tweeted or whatever you want to do with it to make it better, but not the
I don't
Second
disagree,
Amendment.
But in the meantime, you don't want your police outgunned. I mean, you're
talking
about two separate
guns
issues.
At Gander Mountain. I mean, they're not getting them where you think they're getting them.
Well, they're getting them all kinds of places.
Right. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should police be able to purchase military surplus equipment, which could include armored vehicles, grenade launchers, and riot gear? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, was it racist to troll Joe Donnelly with a mariachi band over his family company's outsourcing to Mexico? 65% say yes, it was. 35% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson this week said she sees no correlation between early voting access and higher voter turnout.
The Elections Study Committee met this week to analyze the impact of Indiana voting laws on voter turnout over the last 16 years. That included discussion of automatic voter registration, with the Democratic co-director of the Indiana Election Division touting its benefits and the Republican co-director raising concerns. And Lawson told the committee that she sees no relationship between easier access to early voting and an overall increase in voter turnout. Her comments come in the midst of a lawsuit over a reduction in early voting locations in Marion County. Democrats pounced on Lawson's remarks, pointing to increased turnout in Hamilton County, which saw a jump in early voting locations in the last few elections, and lower turnout since 2008 in Marion County.
John Schwann, it's making early voting easier and increased turnout seem like they'd go hand in hand, but is Secretary Lawson right?
The numbers, I guess, are the numbers. assuming those, and I'm sure they are, the accurate numbers. So you can make the argument, as she is has made, that it doesn't make a significant difference. But again, as suggested in your open, you look at a Hamilton County, predominantly Republican area, where there was greater voter accessibility in terms of early voting, in terms of satellite stations and voting stations and so forth, and you saw turnout up, versus predominantly Democratic Marion County, where you saw, you know, very little, actually shrinkage, I think, right, in terms of the numbers.
Yeah.
So, again, this will be the second time I quote the GAO on this show. I've never done it before, so I might as well get my money's worth. The Government Accountability Office looked at the same issue on a national level and looked at, I think it was 10 studies. Five said that these things actually helped turn out. Four said inconclusive, and one said it actually hurt turnout. So
across the board, there's not a lot.
This is across the board. I mean, there's a split even at an analysis of legitimate studies. And I guess it's what they say about statistics. You can, you know, make any argument you want.
Well, I was hoping you'd say save the GAO stuff for sweep sweep. But
well, that's I got some more where that came from.
Oh, boy.
Is this perhaps not the right? I mean, this is what a lot of the focus of the committee ended up being on, and what Democrats have sort of focused on with Connie Lawson. But shouldn't be the point here that why would we try to restrict early voting access anyway?
I think that's right. I think the problem for Secretary Lawson is that intuitively her facts don't make sense, and that's not fake news. Most of us would agree, I think, that if you have more access to voting booths, if you can go more often. If you can go
just in Chicago
over many different at your convenience or many different places, and all of these things are available with technology, that it would help make voting be more inclusive. So that's really the thing here, and I think that's what we should ultimately be getting to. I think it is interesting that because of partisanship in Marion County, you need a unanimous vote, and the Republicans always vote against having additional, I shouldn't say always, since 2008 have voted against having additional places to vote. In the other counties, that hasn't been the case, and so you have more places to vote over a longer period of time. And so that also hurts Secretary Lawson's case. So while the facts are the facts, the perception of these facts run counter, and so people think, well, we should have more access.
When we talk about that access and higher turnout, one of the things that was discussed by the committee, and now you have some Republicans saying they're going to push for this, is same-day registration.
Mm-hmm. I think both are good ideas.
Do you think same-day registration has been brought up before, notably by Democrats last session? It was shot down fairly quickly by Milo Smith, the House Elections Committee chair. But do you think, with Republicans starting to get on board, is this going to become a reality?
I hope so, because all of this has been part of a national voter suppression effort on their part. It doesn't take, you know, we're talking about small numbers here and there, but you're going to have numbers add up, and they disproportionately affect Democratic voters. And frankly, I think there ought to be one rule for all. I mean, I have been arguing that if the Democrats in the donut counties are willing to let the Republicans vote early and at convenient locations, why can't that happen with the Republican in Marion County? And if it can't happen with the Republican in Marion County, then it shouldn't happen in the donuts, because it is unfair, and it's blatantly unfair. We have been in favor of participation even in counties where we know we're not going to carry. And they won't do the same thing. And Jim Merritt's the new county chairman. He needs to step up and do what's right with this, or the appeal should be made to the other counties to say, no more.
Should this be a no-brainer? Should it just be, yes, we want to have more sites. We want to make early voting access more possible.
I was in favor of legislation that has been filed over the last couple of years that changes the rules and says you don't need unanimous support of the county election board. And the reason for that is both parties have blocked this in different areas.
Yeah.
In Hendricks County, we've wanted vote centers for years. You know, we're home to Connie Lawson, Secretary of State Connie Lawson. She's been a great champion for that effort, and the Democrats continually blocked it. You know, so the local conditions matter. The partisanship obviously has an impact. If you can't figure out with your other party how to do it fairly, now we have in Hendricks County. I don't know why you can't get your act together in Marion County, but
it isn't us.
In Hendricks County, in God's country, we are figuring out how to make people vote.
They have grenade launchers
earlier.
Apparently there.
But same day registration, automatic registration, these are becoming more mainstream ideas.
And
they used to be only
sense.
Democrat ideas in Oregon, California, but now more Republican states are doing it too.
Well, the Indiana Supreme Court ruled this this week that it can't force the Department of Child Services to comply with caseload requirements in state law.
State law sets caseload limits for DCS caseworkers. They aren't supposed to oversee more than 17 active cases at once. Compliance is determined by averaging caseloads in each of 19 DCS regions across the state, and only one region currently meets the statutory standard. A DCS caseworker who was overseeing 43 cases sued, asking a court to force DCS to comply with the law. But Supreme Court Justice Jeffrey Slaughter writes that state law isn't specific when it comes to enforcing the caseload requirements. The decision says compelling DCS to comply with the limits would entangle the court in the day-to-day operation of the state agency.
John Ketzberger, what's the point of a law that the court won't enforce?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'm going to try to answer it, but it's going to sound silly. Clearly, the court has decided that this is a question for the legislature to deal with. And, you know, Justice Slaughter's decision says your law is not good enough. It's not, the definitions aren't proper, and you need to go back and fix it so that the DCS and everyone else knows exactly what they should do. Clearly, the legislature wants these caseloads to be reduced. Clearly, the court wants the legislature to write a better law. And I think that's what Justice Slaughter's decision was. And I think that's what's going to have to happen in order to have that law have some teeth or meaning.
This is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a new law. It's been around for several years now. It seems at this point, certainly after this ruling, aspirational at best. Do you think the legislature is sort of content with that?
I don't think they're content because, as was pointed out, this is a law that they enacted after there were some really bad things that happened in the state of Indiana because of ostensibly overloaded caseworkers. So I think there will be pressure spurred in part by this decision to bring additional funds to the table that would allow people to be hired and caseloads therefore to be reduced. What struck me about it is, and I'm not saying there's a dramatic difference in federal jurisprudence and state level, but I think about how many times we've seen federal district court judges say, well, finding a problem, but I'll find a solution. And I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I'm struck by the difference in the two approaches.
There were questions during the hearing from some of the justices about this seems almost like it should be administrative policy and not something that is statutory in the code. Is that perhaps the better solution here, that the legislature just gets out of this business of saying it has to be exactly this many caseworkers or this many cases per worker?
Well, probably, because they can't control the intake, right? So caseloads have doubled. In large part, this is one of the reasons Governor Holcomb is so focused on attacking the opiate crisis, for a number of reasons. One of them is that children are a victim of this, too, right? So the caseloads have doubled.
Right.
The legislature, when they established these ratios, never contemplated that they would double in a five-year period. You couldn't have. So administrative flexibility, sure, but I think, you look back 13 years, and we had the worst caseloads in the country. The legislature had to come in 2005 and 2006, hire 800 new caseworkers, spend hundreds of millions of dollars. And that problem, in retrospect, seems minor compared to the problems we have today and need to attack and put money into.
So does that flexibility really mean that this law shouldn't exist in the first place?
The law was passed so that they could appear to do something about what was a national crisis, the fact that we overworked and underfunded DCS for years. Okay, so they could say, look, we've done something. They have never appropriated sufficient funds to that agency, either to hire or to retain. Those are very tough jobs, and we need people that are committed, and they shouldn't be making a financial sacrifice to do a job that's so difficult. And we won't put the money behind it. The legislature won't put the resources behind it. It is going to be a perennial problem until they do. And that's what's going on here. They can look at that and say, see, we passed a law. We've solved the problem. But they'll never put the resources behind it to do it.
And yet, it's more comprehensive than that.
But there was a significant funding increase asked for by DCS. It was an original increase, and then they came back halfway through session and asked for even more because of more increases in those cases. And the legislature gave them every dollar that they asked for.
Right. And did they ask for enough? What are they paying?
What are they paying the
average caseworker?
I don't know.
Probably somewhere around $35,000. You try keeping body and soul together in a family on that.
So is that perhaps the legislative problem here? Is there's only so much they can, I mean, it's sort of a push and pull. It's, well, you need to tell us what to do. Well, you're not telling us enough, and well, you're not giving us enough money. Well, you need to. It just seems to go back and forth between the agency and the legislature. Then,
but you're funding the consequence of drug addiction, lack of economic opportunity for a lot of these people, workforce issues that all manifest themselves in abuse at home, right? And so, I mean, yeah, you can be reactive and say, well, money, more caseworkers. But if you're not on the front end, like Governor Holcomb was focused on, workforce, education, and the opioid addiction.
Maybe if we had dealt with the opioid crisis a year earlier or 2 years earlier under Mike Pence, maybe the crisis wouldn't be quite as pronounced.
Well, that's Indiana. On that note, that's Indiana Recon Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.